Hello again, and welcome to another NABBW teleseminar on a topic we Boomer women want to know about, getting our financial houses in order as we look toward retirement. This evening, we are continuing to talk about how we can overcome some self-sabotaging financial habits and emotions that many of us have developed so that we can start to save more toward our retirement. Retirement savings is, of course, a topic we've talked about before, and it's a hugely important one, especially considering that current research shows that 50% of us at least have not saved for retirement and are therefore feeling some real anxiety about how we're going to afford retirement. Pam, I think you sent me an article recently that said something like 50% of us have $1,000 saved toward retirement. Do I recall that right?
Probably not that low, but
oh, good.
Not nearly enough.
Okay. Well, obviously, whether it's that low or not, this is still a crucial problem, and especially considering that longevity experts now tell us that given advances in health and safety, we might be retired for 30 or even 40 years. So we started this discussion about financial self-sabotage earlier this month, and tonight we continue to look at the many ways that we've sabotaged ourselves financially, and hopefully we'll also have time to take a look at how we can try to stop this behavior. But before we get into that, Pam, let me give our listeners a bit of insight about this call. My name is Ann Holmes. I'm your moderator and the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. This call, like those we do every month, is one of the ways we serve our membership. Tonight, we are again speaking with one of our favorite guest experts, Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, a chartered retirement planning consultant and NABBW's retirement planning associate. And we'll be discussing 8 money-sabotaging emotions. Last time we talked about this earlier, I think it was on the 2nd of this month, and we talked about habits, bad habits. But now we're talking about money-sabotaging emotions. And let me tell you listeners a little bit about Pam and how it is that she's so qualified to talk about this. Pam Sams is an expert in personal finance who always covers important information related to money and financial planning for us. Sadly, financial planning continues to be something too many of us Boomer women don't know enough about. Pam is president of Jackson Sams Financial Services, a financial planning and wealth management firm located in Herndon, Virginia, near the Dulles Corridor. Her firm's focus is helping women understand the importance of financial and retirement planning by learning the importance of placing our own needs first. Pam begins her work with each client by making sure she understands each woman's goals and then works up an individualized financial plan. Now, based on our many prior discussions, Pam and I are very aware of two things. Number one, Americans are living longer, and number two, as a group, we are really not prepared to retire. In fact, sometimes I think when I listen to my kids, one is a millennial and one's a Gen X, I think that they're doing a pretty good job towards preparing for savings for retirement. I think you'd have to tell me if this is true, Pam, but I kind of wonder if somehow the younger generation, which has a much longer time to be able to save that money, might be getting themselves better organized earlier. But we'll have to figure out if you've observed that in your practice. It's just a thought that I've been having. But regardless of that, let me start by saying thanks for joining us again tonight, Pam.
Thank you very much for having me once again. I know we had a little bit of a bit between the first call and the second call, but it's just as important to discuss some of the money sabotaging emotions that people experience. You know, the habits go along, of course, with the emotions. So we'll be discussing probably 8 money sabotaging emotions tonight. But to the effect that you had just asked about the millennials, in fact, millennials and Gen X are doing much better than boomers in saving for retirement. I believe it's probably a matter of, you know, when they were actually born. They went through a lot of, you know, saw the 2008 crisis and some other issues in terms of economic situation. So they're like, well, we really don't want to go through that. So they tend to be a lot better with saving than boomers when it comes to retirement. So hopefully, you know, the next generations after, you know, the boomers will be fairly prepared for the retirement planning since they have a little bit longer time horizon to save. And it seems they're taking the savings part really to heart and putting more money away towards retirement.
Al, that's such a good thing to hear, because it's been very concerning to me in the many years that I've been working with and studying us baby boomers, and of course being one myself, as I believe you are too, that it's been very concerning to me to realize what a poor job that we were doing in this area, which is so important because of the fact that we have the opportunity to live so much longer than our parents did. And I know that one of the bad habits that we discussed last time was, you know, the bad habit, so to speak, of trying to keep up with the Joneses, and probably related to that was trying to give things to our kids to make sure that they had the best life possible, you know, make sure they had all the classes and the lessons and life-enhancing activities that we might not have had as kids, so we thought that we'd make sure that they did. But really, it's really got to be that same, you know, into the lifeboat thing of, you know, take care of yourself first, and we just... doesn't seem that we've been good at that. So at the same time, I'm hearing that psychologists and financial advisors tell us that people are not only are they in emotional traps and have mental biases that are keeping us from making the most of our money, but we still tend to think of ourselves as rational spenders and investors and people who are capable of optimizing our hard-earned money. So it's really a trap, I think, that we have put ourselves in, and I certainly am hoping that we can discuss these emotions today, and then, you know, give people a feeling of maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel, and we can figure out how to overcome the sabotage of these emotions. So that said, I'll just say one more thing, is that, you know, we all heard growing up, at least my dad always was talking about the importance of putting my part of my allowance every week when I got my allowance, you know, part of it had to go in my piggy bank, and we had to save for a rainy day, which when I was a kid, you know, that was, I took that literally, and I was trying to figure out what does he mean by that, but you know, now that the metaphorical rain has started falling and we're getting to, as boomers, to be so close to the traditional retirement age, some of us have reached it. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who had her birthday, and she was talking about signing up for Medicare, and I said, how could that be? And she said, well, because I'm 65. And I said, oh, I hadn't realized that she was at that point yet. So, but now that rain has started to fall, and we're just realizing that what you're saying is that one big reason that we can't afford to retire is our emotions. That's clearly something that we should start talking about and addressing and taking action with if we can. So you listed 8 money sabotaging emotions. The first one you mentioned was anxiety.
Yes, the first one is anxiety, because a lot of people really just are very anxious when it comes to their money, worried about it, worried about losing it, worried about having enough. So that when you're really stands in the forefront of most people when it comes to their emotions around money. And sometimes, you know, I'm going to tie a lot of it in with some of the habits that we talked about the last time, is that with that anxiety, we tend to freak out, and then we end up having unhealthy spending habits or unhealthy spending habits that really affects the way that we deal with our money. So the anxiety can really affect your finances big time if you don't take it under consideration and know that you're really anxious about money. Sometimes, you know, it gets to the point where people are, you know, they don't want to look at, you know, especially when, you know, we have a financial crisis back, you know, several years back, no one wanted to look at their statements. You didn't open your bank account, statements, you didn't do anything because you were
anxious. I stacked them up in my folder.
Yes, exactly. With what was going on. But, you know, unfortunately, I always tell people you have to know where you stand at all times, and I know sometimes that puts more people in an anxious state as well. What I tell people, if you feel that you are, you know, anxious about your money, you know, that sometimes leads to, like I said, unhealthy spending habits and also poor financial choices. So you don't want to be in a situation where you're too anxious about your money. So I always tell people, you know, it sounds a little counterintuitive, but what you want to do is really kind of indulge those money anxieties for a little bit of a time. I would probably say maybe about 5 minutes. I always tell people it's kind of wallowing in your sorrow for a little bit.
Okay.
It alleviates some of the stress around the anxiety, but longer, you know, 5 minutes or more per day, you know, we have to kind of get off that pity party for a while. But allow yourself enough time to deal with, I'm anxious around money, but also from there, how can I do better? You know, really taking the validity of I'm anxious around my money, but now that I've had the pity party for myself, what are some things that I can be doing better in order to move myself forward with me versus kind of wallowing in those bothersome thoughts that can creep in your head all day if you kind of stay there all day about, you know, I don't have enough money, what am I going to do in retirement? If I don't have enough money, you know, I'm going to be a bag lady, whatever. Don't let all of the anxiety build up so much that it stops you in your tracks where you're not making good financial decisions or choices, and then tend to also partner that with unhealthy spending habits.
Mm-hmm. I think I've heard that anxiety, you know, can actually, you know, be paralyzing, that we get so anxious.
Mm-hmm.
That we just can't do anything, and you know that's
correct.
No action is certainly not the direction that is going to be anything that's going to help us. So what you're saying is indulge yourself for like 5 minutes a day. You're saying you can allow that much of anxiety, but then you need to move on with some kind of action plan too.
Yeah, and you know, the kind of the main mission is to at least come up with one thing each day that you can do to control your situation that may be causing that anxiety. That gives you in more of an empowered state versus I'm anxious about it. So at least if it's one small thing, you know, I increase my 401k contribution by 2%, or I'm putting an extra $50 into my savings account to build up my cash reserve. Something that you can do each day to move yourself forward for in terms of your money habits, so you're making some type of progress instead of just being stuck in your tracks and being too anxious about it and just having those thoughts reoccur in your head all day about, you know, I'm not in the situation where I want to be financially. Give yourself enough time to do it, alleviate some stress, and then move forward with taking some action.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that we've not only identified an emotion, but given steps to overcome it. So I appreciate that we're trying to be helpful here, not just lay it all out in scariness, but you know, be recognizing
exactly
that there is something that we can do besides identify the emotions. So the next emotion that we need to talk about, according to the list that you and I've worked on, is jealousy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of partners with that the spending habit of keeping up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm.
You fall into a situation of you see your best friend or your buddy or your girlfriend with a new something. And then, you know, for some reason or the other, of course, we're human beings, there's going to be a little bit of jealousy there, you know, too. And, you know, just like we explained with keeping up with the Joneses being a sabotaging habit, on the other side of that, that emotion causes jealousy, and then that also puts us in a state where we're making poor financial choices based on what someone else could be doing. You know, if they bought a new house or they've put an addition to their house or they've done something and then you're maybe still renting or you may be, you know, still in an older model car and they have a new one, you don't want to react where you need to go get the same things or one up that person to keep up with them. That will ultimately leave you in a situation where you may be taking on more debt than you should be just to impress or to keep up with someone, because that emotion of jealousy overcame you where you need to go out and say, okay, I need to kind of one up this person because you have this, I'm going to go get this or something better.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely true that so many times we want to do not just parallel to what they've done, but the jealousy habit means that exactly what you just said, we want this or something better. So that's just human nature, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you want to do here, you know, because I, like you said, I don't want to outline all the negative emotions that money sabotaging emotions come up with. I also want to, you know, kind of reframe and let people know some things that you can do to help yourself there. So I would turn jealousy more into a growth opportunity by using it as a period of self-examination about your finances. So, you know, think what is maybe missing in your life that you don't have, you know, so, but do you actually need it? You know, that's one of those needs, wants, conversations that you do need to have with yourself. You know, if somebody has this, do you really need that also? So it gives you a chance to do some self-examination. And I always tell people, you know, sometimes we as human beings, we always focus on what we lack and not so much what we have. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of gratitude journals. You know, you've probably heard people with, you know, keeping a gratitude journal daily, about really taking inventory of the things that you are grateful for and the things that you do have in your life. You know, some people, you know, you may not have a in the latest model a car, but you have a car. You know, there's third world countries where people, you know, walk or don't even have transportation to get to the next village. So there's so many things that we can be grateful for instead of kind of turning that jealousy from a negative. Really look at those growth opportunities for self-examination to take inventory on the things that you do have to be grateful for. So you're really staying focused on the abundance rather than what you're lacking in your life. And from there, you know, that helps you make smarter money decisions by fueling that desire that, you know, I am already abundant. You know, here are some of the things that I do have versus, you know, I have to go get more things because I'm lacking some things that others may have and I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good advice there. And certainly with some of the things that we've been seeing going on around the world lately, we certainly have many opportunities to have the abundance mindset working for us. So I think that's really great to bring that to the forefront here. I'm not sure if everybody would naturally, you know, realize that a way to deal with jealousy is to think abundantly, but I think it's a perfect way to handle the jealousy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's always, like I said, you know, second, you know, nature to you know, to kind of focus on the lacking versus the actually the good stuff that we have. So I think that's a way to alleviate the jealousy emotion because, you know, the jealousy is all about what others have and what you don't. So if you focus in on the things that you do have, that really kind of subsides that jealousy feeling. So that won't overcome you as much as you know, some other money sabotaging emotion. You can basically eliminate that particular one if you focus more on the abundance versus the lack that you have in your life.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. The third money sabotaging emotion that you and I want to discuss is regret.
Yeah, and regret is a rather big emotion because a lot of times we just kind of kick ourselves over lousy money decisions that we've made in the past. And that you know, just like the anxiety emotion that we had talked about before, that also stops us and we procrastinate because we don't want to make a lousy money decision anymore. So, you know, with, I always, you know, reference the, you know, the financial crisis we've just experienced. A lot of people say, well, why didn't I, you know, move to cash earlier? Or why did I have so much in, you know, certain investments? Because, you know, now, you know, I have to make up and recoup what I lost. And so people are regretting some of the decisions that they may have made or may not have made during that decision, I mean, during that time period. So that tends to put us in a more procrastinating type situation where we're not making proper money decisions because some of that regret seeps back in on I don't want to make that decision again. So sometimes even, and I see it a lot, especially with women, we tend to be a lot, we tend to be more conservative with our investing because we don't want to make a poor decision because we had a poor decision in the past, or we may have experienced an advisor or got advice that was not good, so we regret that particular situation. So we tend to languish in stuff that we already know. So things that, you know, cash and bonds and things that tend to be a lot more conservative because we don't want to regret making a poor decision. So that's always, you know, kind of a top of mind when it comes to one of those money sabotaging emotion. Regret stops you procrastinate, stops you from making decisions, thus you're procrastinating. So, you know, if you are in making changes to your, let's say, investments, your 401k or anything at work, you know, some of those things that you may have decided in the past, you say, well, I don't want to go there again, so I'm not going to make any changes. And then you just kind of keep the same stuff for the next 10 years. Or, you know, you didn't start saving for retirement when you should have, and now you think it's too late. Some of those attitudes, you know, kind of defeat the purpose when you're trying to do the best you can with your money. So what you're doing there is, you know, in order to reframe it and do better, it's really channel your regret into a learning opportunity. Regret tends to be a highly useful emotion that signals to us, you know, where in life we need to improve, and then it motivates us to make those improvements. So, you know, what you're looking at there is forgiving yourself for the mistake, you know, admit that it happened. There's no way you can go by. I always use the quote, if hindsight was 20/20, everybody would be, you know, in a better situation. But we just can't. We don't have the hindsight, you know, we don't have the 20/20 of what would have happened if we had made X decision in the past. So what you want to do is forgive yourself for the mistake, then focus on strategies that you'll steer you clear from those same mistakes, and then also what you can do better in the future. So you don't want it to, just like the anxiety emotion, you don't want it to stop you in your tracks. It's a learning opportunity. Say, okay, now I know, you know, that's not, maybe that's not the way I should have handled that before. Acknowledge that that happened. Steer clear of those mistakes and mishaps, so you can make better choices for the future. So basically, it's learning from your mistakes in order to grow financially. So that's what you're really looking at when you're looking at regret, not letting it stop you. Gain insight so you can make embrace a decision-making approach that will be able to move you forward for the future.
Yes, I think when you talk about procrastination, there's that cliche that says not to decide is to decide. So that concept where you're saying, sitting on the fence and saying, well, you know, I'm going to think about that some more because I don't want to regret that I made the wrong decision. And so when you take no action because you're procrastinating, you have actually made the decision of no action, or to say no, and that's really not a decision that moves things forward. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
Important.
I mean, Yeah, and that's the thing about, you know, procrastination that I always explain to people, you know, that come see me or, you know, looking to make changes is that, you know, you're going to make a decision either way. Either you're going to stay in your current course of situation or you're going to make a decision to change and do something different. Either way, it's a decision. You know, one may, you know, be a better decision than the other, but by taking no action, you're actually, like you said, making a decision to stay in your current course. It may not be the best case scenario for you, but, you know, it's a decision that that you've made, so you don't want to regret, you know, several years from now, say, well, I should have, you know, 10 years ago when I met with a planner or 10 years ago when I could have did this, why didn't I make some changes before? Mm-hmm. So it happened. You know, I always tell people when they come see me, you know, it's like, you know, either going to the principal or going to the dentist. I don't know. You know, those are two places people never want to be.
Right.
and it's always going to their financial advisor or meeting with an advisor. Sometimes they feel some of this, carry some of this baggage of regret. And I always tell people is that you can only start where you are right now. Forget what happened in the past. We need to focus on where you are right now to move you forward, because languishing in the past is not going to get you anywhere. So you really just need to kind of start where you are, acknowledge that it happened, you made a mistake, you should have started earlier, but now we have this time period that we can move forward and focus on strategies that will move you forward versus looking backwards.
Very good. Now, related in my mind to regret is point number four, the emotion that we want to discuss. Fourth is embarrassment. I don't know if everybody sees a relationship between regret and embarrassment, but to me, at least in my mind, they are quite often going hand in hand.
Yeah, it's similar emotion that people have is that they're embarrassed that, you know, and I get that a lot as well, is that, you know, I'm this age and I haven't done all the things that I wanted to. So sometimes it could be an embarrassing situation from that particular standpoint. What I am looking at, you know, some of the embarrassing things that people experience is that you know, the emotion when it comes to money sabotaging behaviors. I think we had mentioned last phone call you had talked about your raise and then going out to lunch all the time and, mm-hmm. you know, and absorbing
right.
that. Sometimes, you know, from an embarrassment standpoint, you know, friends want to go out to eat or out to dinner, and sometimes you, because you're embarrassed to say, I really can't afford to do this right now because I'm on a budget or I'm saving for a house or whatever. So sometimes that money sabotaging emotion that comes up in you is embarrassment that you don't want to display to friends and family that you're in a particular situation financially that may harm your particular budget situation where everybody else is going out and you have to say no to this particular situation because it may put you in a situation where you cannot afford it right now, or you have another strategy or game plan that you have those monies allocated to, especially when you're going to, you know, really high scale restaurants and, you know, it's, you know, well up, you know, $75, $100, you know, and over, mm-hmm. and you really just can't afford that. Sometimes that embarrassment of that emotion gets to you, and then you end up doing something that you probably shouldn't do in order to keep yourself from being embarrassed from that emotion. So you use a credit card to, you know, cover it. And then when the bill comes next month, you know, you've taken resources that you may have put towards paying down debt or building up your cash reserve in order to pay for something that may not have fit in your budget before because of that embarrassment that came up in you that you didn't say no.
Right. It's very, very true.
Yeah. So, you know, what you're looking at here is really, you know, when you're, you know, with someone that you know well, you know, be honest, you know, with friends, mm-hmm. you know, especially when you have friends, tell them up front, you know, I'm looking to save money and, you know, I would prefer, you know, to decline, or is there somewhere we can go that, you know, may not be as, you know, in within my budget? And, mm-hmm. you know, good friends are going to understand where you're coming from and, you know, encourage you not to overspend if they're good friends. You know, if
right.
you tell them, you know, I really can't afford to go out with you tonight because I'm saving for a house or
mm-hmm.
Paying down my student loans or I'm doing something. If they're, you know, if you're honest and open and they are good friends and they're old friends, then, you know, that shouldn't be any particular situation. Now, on the other hand, if you're in a social situation, you know, where someone new and you're not comfortable with,
right.
you know, with that, try to avoid the budget busting scenarios altogether if you can, you know. So instead of going out to the posh restaurants, maybe, you know, I'd go out, you know, for a waterfront or something, or can we go out for drinks or casual
mm-hmm.
drinks versus, you know, going to the posh restaurant. You know, there's kind of ways to kind of skirt the situation
right.
If you have to. You know, ultimately you have to realize that, you know, it's about what you want to do with your financial goals. And not have anyone or anything take away from that. So,
mm-hmm.
like I said, that embarrassment comes up in you because we're human beings and we get embarrassed that, you know, you go someplace and, you know, your friend suggests that you want to go out somewhere and you say, well, I really can't afford these things. Sometimes you really have to just be open and honest because the money sabotage and emotion of embarrassment can put you in a situation where you're overspending and you've kind of either busted your budget, you didn't save for your goals that you said you would based on, you know, those behaviors and that emotion that popped up of embarrassment. So
mm-hmm.
try to, you know, figure out a way, especially, like I said, if you have close friends, you know, they more than likely will kind of know, you know, what you have going on in your life in terms of your goals and what you're trying to achieve. Just be open and honest. Say, you know, I'm saving up for this particular thing. Can we maybe split the check or, you know, do something where,
right.
you know, we'll be able to have fun all together, but not bust your budget and overspend.
Mm-hmm. Excellent advice and something that many of us have to learn, I think, by experience, by the unfortunate experience of doing it wrong. But anyway, let's move on to number 5 on our list of money sabotaging emotions, and that would be sadness.
Yeah, sadness as a money sabotaging emotion really comes to a time period where you generally experience loss through either divorce, losing a loved one, you know, maybe get a windfall from inheritance, some scenario that has created sadness in your life. So what happens there when there's a sense of mourning, you know, there may be some attachment to money or also thinking about what you need to do afterwards, especially, you know, people I work with, a lot of divorced women. So in a sad situation where, you know, an end of a marriage, there tends to be a lot of either overspending because they're not sure what life is like after divorce, so they're probably still spending the same way,
mm-hmm.
or also one of those spending, one of those habits we talked about before, I need to make myself feel better because, you know, I've went through this, you know, horrible situation, and now I really want to make myself feel a lot better and that
right,
I'm worth
so
it.
Retail therapy.
So, you know. Exactly, the retail therapy. So a lot of, you know, money goes towards doing that as well. So in some instances, money becomes a symbol of loss that really kind of replaces kind of the absence of that person being there. You know, either, you know, you've lost a spouse or a loved one or grandparents or a marriage has ended, some sense of mourning usually comes with some money factors and money emotions around money and either overspending or, you know, what I see a lot sometimes as well is that, you know, if you receive inheritance from grandparents or, you know, either, you know, parents or grandparents, people get attached to certain investments that maybe perhaps they shouldn't have anymore because of the attachment to the person who they inherited from. So sometimes that influences our investment decisions, our financial decisions based on that void being there. So let's say, you know, you inherited, you know, let's say an older stock that may not be doing very well, but your grandparent gave it to you when you were six. You know, you may want to still keep hold of that, even though it may be losing tremendous value because of, you know, of what market conditions have done, but you keep on hold of it because of that sadness emotion. It's like, well, if I get rid of it, it's like you're getting rid of my grandparent.
Right.
And so some of that happens along that emotion of sadness. Money tends to be the fill the void and becomes that symbol of loss. And it really affects us from making sound financial decisions in a state of loss. So that's why generally, especially with widows, I work with a lot of widows as well, is that try not to have them make any financial decisions for at least a year after they've their spouse has passed away, because there's so much going on from a sadness standpoint that
right.
I would recommend being in a better frame of mind to make proper financial decisions about moving money or doing anything with inheritance or, you know, accounts and things like that until you're kind of over that sadness, because you don't want that to cloud and overshadow what you may be doing. So the way to kind of deal with that, you know, even if you are grieving, you still need to make some decisions about your new financial scenario. So what you want to do is really kind of find somebody that you trust, either financial planner or somebody that's, you know, in your family that could also kind of partner with you and tell you what needs to be done. Because there's, you know, in a state of sadness, there's so much that needs to be done, especially in a loss of a spouse or parents or even divorce. There's a lot of decisions. So if you have somebody there that will be able to kind of hold your hand throughout the process, so you won't let that sadness overcome your situation and make poor financial decisions, you want to make sure you kind of partner with someone that will be able to help you out.
Right.
So that way you can put things under control. So you don't have to do all of the heavy lifting for yourself in the state of sadness. So I would probably recommend doing, you know, you're still going to have to make some decisions, but find somebody that will be able to let you know what needs to be done, help you through the process, and coach you so you won't feel that you're making poor financial decisions, or you don't even want to deal with it at all. A lot of times people just don't want to deal with it because that sadness emotion is there. So you don't want to go into avoidance mode, because you do have to make some decisions. So partner with somebody, a trusted person that will be able to help guide you through the process.
Yes, I hadn't really realized the depth of how that permeates into the situation that you're talking about, Pam, but I'm realizing it's not just the concept that you might not want to let go of an investment that's no longer. I was thinking when you first talked about investments, you know, that you were talking about stocks or bonds or that type of investment, but then I was realizing it also applies to real estate. You know, you might have a home that you bought. It was the first home that you and your spouse bought, and now you're dealing with the widow, and she's saying, you know, well, we've always had that house as a rental house. You know, we don't live in it anymore, but, we've had it as a rental house, and I don't want to get rid of it because it was our first big financial decision that we did together. But you know, maybe it's no longer in a good neighborhood, and it's not, you know, cost-efficient to keep it maintained or something like that. So I can see where there would be tons of emotion that would be like landmines that are in these type of mourning situations that you're talking about. So really good that you explained that one, because I hadn't realized exactly the magnitude of how sadness can impact us. I think we've got mm-hmm. another big one here on point number six, though, and that's guilt.
Yeah, guilt is a tricky emotion that
okay.
people experience, especially from a money standpoint. And what I'm really talking about here is when people experience, big windfalls or, people win lotteries or, all of a sudden, they, let's say, come into money. Sometimes, in our psyches, feel that they don't deserve it. They feel guilty. So what happens is spending relieves that guilt temporarily. So people go out and say, well, I really don't deserve this much money. Maybe I shouldn't have as much. And then they kind of go start spending. So that emotion of guilt that I don't deserve to have, this money or these extravagant gifts or, people are less fortunate than I do. They tend to go out and, spend in order to alleviate some of that guilty feeling as a result. So it's kind of, I guess, similar to a retail therapy, but mm-hmm. on a different situation, because we tend to spend down. Statistically, people who have, won the lottery, if you catch up with these people 5 years later, they're back in the same situation than before mm-hmm. they had won the lottery. So they tend to have a guilty money sabotaging emotion. Even though on the onset you're really psyched about, winning the lottery or you came into, a certain amount of money, that it's people in their minds tend to have what I call a financial temperature. It's kind of set at a certain amount, and in your mind you may be only worth this, and now you have this. If they don't match up, just our emotions and our mind tends to say, well, we need to have our financial thermostat set to where we were before. So that's what mm-hmm. tends to happen with people who come into windfalls and or lottery or some type of thing. They get guilty about having so much that they tend to go overspend with mm-hmm. that. So kind of what my emphasis is and how to fix that is really having a financial plan. I'm all about financial planning. Having a financial plan for the money is essential, because if you don't have, where you need to allocate things, all of a sudden, there's always something that you can go buy with extra money. If you don't have things set out structurally to say this is where this could be allocated, and then also have spending limits will also help you focus as well, so you're not on a free-for-all spending binge, so you have some type of structure set up. That is really where you want to focus in on. But also a healthier way to deal with some of that guilt may be to channel some of those resources from a charitable standpoint. So let's say, you have your money allocated in your financial plan. You also might say, those people who may be less fortunate than I can give to, some a charity, or maybe set up a nonprofit or a foundation or something that you can do to give back. And then that way this takes the focus off of you and your guilt and allows mm-hmm. you to use your good fortunes to do something more helpful for somebody else as well. So you want to look at alleviating some of that guilt of I don't deserve it, to if I'm going to, instead of spending, maybe go ahead and start contributing some to giving to nonprofits or charity as well. So there's mm-hmm. A lot of strategies that will also help from a tax efficient standpoint as well, if you give away to nonprofits or appreciated stock or things like that, and to charities or churches. So using some of that good fortune to do good versus having that mm-hmm. guilty feeling and then going out and going on a spending spree.
Right.
So it's kind of use what you have, establishing your financial plan and what is essential and necessary for you. But then if you don't you know, want, if you think you still have too much and you're guilty about it, there's ways to contribute to charity as well on you know, give to the less fortunate.
That's very true. Actually, we have an NABBW member. Her name is Shirley Press. She's a pediatric physician, and she wrote a book, I don't know if you ever heard of it, called Pressing My Luck. It's the subtitle is A Doctor's Lottery Journey, and it's a memoir. She talks about how she was a hospitalist. She worked at the hospital in the pediatric emergency room, and she just happened to go one day into the gift shop for something, and while she was paying for whatever she was getting at the gift shop, which I think was a candy bar or something insignificant like that, she just, you know, on a whim, she picked up a lottery ticket too, which this takes place in Florida, and she won. I pulled out her book here so I can tell you exactly. I would not have memorized it otherwise, but I happen to know where that book is. She won $56 million, and so the take-home on that was $17.5 million. And so the book, she talks about all of these things that you're talking about, the guilt, and she, her parents were Holocaust survivors. So the whole concept of the kind of lifestyle that she'd been brought up in with, you know, parents being Holocaust survivors, and then she was, you know, pretty successful, being that she was a pediatric doctor in the head of the pediatric hospital division at this hospital in Florida. It wasn't like she was having a hard time making ends meet, and she just almost forgot, you know, she put the ticket in her pocket of her white jacket, you know, her white coat, and stuffed it there and forgot about it until, like, a few days later, when they were trying to figure out who won, she said, "Oh, well, maybe I should see if I won." And she did, and it's this fascinating book. And I interviewed her for a teleseminar, but it was just fascinating for her to talk about the challenges that came to her from this journey of winning the money and the guilt that was part of. Part of what happened. And I'm sure in your type of work, you have run into this with other people too. Not necessarily that they wrote books about it, but you know that there is a lot of guilt that comes with that sort of windfall.
Correct. Yeah. And like I said, that's why I would say it's kind of a tricky emotion, because we're doing good. I mean, you've done well. You've done well for yourself, either, you know, through a windfall or, you know, winning a lottery or something like that. But guilt creeps in, because you say, well, who am I to deserve, you know, $17 million, you know, off of a whim? Like you said, especially if she's in a situation where she's doing well from a profession standpoint. So, you know, it's a lot of guilt when people win, you know, the lottery, or they get, you know, a pretty big inheritance or a windfall that they don't think they deserve it. So guilt eats a lot at them. And depending on how they respond to that, like, you know, she wrote a book and she had, you know, things that she did with that, the money. Some people just tend to go, like I said, on a spending spree on, you know, getting all of the things that they hadn't had before, or, like I said, going to what I call a financial thermostat, where I need to reset myself to what I'm comfortable with and what I'm used to. So they tend to spend more money. So that's why I said, you know, using it for more good with charities, at least that way, you know, it's not going to stuff and things that you can buy for yourself, but helping out others if you are in a situation where you feel really guilty about having more than enough than you would ever use in your lifetime.
Right. And I like it when I hear people like, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates with their charitable foundations, you know, people that
correct,
they have more money than they could possibly spend if they, you know, even tried to. I think that it's good that they take on the point of view of, you know, helping humanity as opposed to, you know, just building more and better houses and bigger garages and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, exactly. and buying another car or another airplane or something, you know.
Right.
And that's why I said people start filling the void with just more stuff, but, you know, that's really not going to do as much. And I do, you know, like what they do with their foundation, because it really gives it back to people in need and people who actually need it. Like you said, it's, you know, your money that you're not going to need in your lifetime. Why not, you know, help out others with that?
Very, very important for those of us who find ourselves in that situation. Keeping in mind our time here, I don't want to dwell on that one too long. We'll move on to number seven, which is feeling overwhelmed. And I think as women, I think the concept of overwhelm is something that I don't know if you can become an adult woman without having felt that at some point or another. Or maybe maybe you have to be a mother. Maybe you have to become a parent before you become overwhelmed. I'm not sure.
I think probably for both aspects, being a woman and, you know, being a mother, yeah, I get this one a lot, is that, you know, we tend to, especially as women, have way too much on our plates at any one given time that we can deal with. And sometimes, and most of the time, the money issues tend to be put on the back burner when we do feel overwhelmed. So feeling overwhelmed as a money sabotaging emotion, you know, if there's, you know, confusing, you know, making, are you confused about making financial decisions on your, you know, situation, or if you have mountains of credit card debt, or if you just kind of really trying to dig your way out, feeling overwhelmed by money issues also puts us in a paralysis state and prevent us from tackling what needs to be done. So that's one of the things that get a lot of times, is that, you know, people come to me and say, you know, I am just so overwhelmed. I don't even know where to start with the situation. You know, like I said, I work with a lot of divorced women. So, you know, that's everything from how do I, you know, getting a lawyer, and, you know, just in the early processes of it, there's so much on the plate to determine, you know, how do I even go through this? There's so much overwhelmed, they don't even know where to start. And like I said, the money issue, of course, tends to be put on the back burner. So you don't want to become paralyzed in order to prevent your, you know, from tackling what really needs to be done. So what you want to do there is by taking some action again, doing something small will help counter the freeze instinct and give you that nudge that you really need to get working towards your goals. So, you know, even if you put aside, you know, what I generally do with people, with some clients, is that, you know, on a weekly basis, maybe carve out an hour, maybe 2 hours on balancing your checkbook, reviewing your budget, something that you can at least say, I'm working towards my goals this week. And so you need to just like anything else, you're going to have to carve out some time when you feel overwhelmed with your finances, because it's, you know, because it's not going to go away. You still need to make those financial decisions, and you still need to address those. You don't want to become paralyzed. So maybe carving out some time to do certain things with your finances. So even if it's putting a new budget in place, or putting all of my transactions into my money management system on a weekly basis to kind of match up what I've been spending during the week, some specific doable step that will and you know, really enable you to start hacking away at some of those money to-dos that most people grapple with on a weekly week-to-week basis. Even if you Google, you know, something that you've been working on with an investment, or how much more money you should be putting towards retirement, you know, some step that you can, you know, slowly but surely take towards your financial goals in order, you know, to move yourself forward, so you won't feel overwhelmed. So I would probably, you know, in order to better control the money, is to carve out a particular part in time where you're dealing with money issues. You know, you have to do it anyway too when you're paying your bills. Maybe carve out some time as well to focus on your financial goals and what you need to work on, where you are, take an assessment, so you won't get stuck, because that's the thing when, like I said, us as women, we tend to get stuck and feel overwhelmed. So you got to keep moving. You got to keep it going. So taking action and taking even something small, some small step, will counter that freeze instinct that you have.
Very good. And then the eighth one, I was so glad to see this one on the list, because I think that I have seen this in so many people that I know, when they're young especially, but let's not keep the suspense going on. What I'm talking about for the eighth emotion that you brought up is overconfidence.
Yeah, and overconfidence is one of those money emotions that affects us from the standpoint where we think we have everything covered. You know, we tell ourselves, you know, I got it, it's no big deal. You know, I get it a lot of times when I meet with people, you know, it's like, oh, I'm all set, I got this, you know, going on, I'm fine, you know, sometimes being overconfident. But sometimes, you know, it's the optimism is good, but you also have to, you know, re-examine from time to time. You don't want to have that optimism undermine your finances, because, you know, if you're in a situation where you're not reevaluating at least on a consistent basis, sometimes that can be, you know, get you in more money trouble than anything else, being overconfident about the particular situation. Because, you know, with everything that goes on in the world, economics, you know, money change, you know, laws and other things, your situation can change, you know, at the drop of a hat, depending on, you know, what people, you know, congressional decisions or economics news or whatever. So you don't want to become too overconfident with your finances, where you're not taking at least a second opinion or checking in from time to time to make sure that you still have a positive outlook on what's going on with your money. So what you want to look at here, in an effort to really change money mindset, is look at from time to time where you are, take an assessment. Are there things that you can be doing different, better? Have things changed in my particular situation that I need to address? Have things changed from a tax standpoint? Are we going into inflation or deflation? So you want to start looking at these things. And, you know, also, do you have enough for retirement? You want to pull out their retirement calculators or have a retirement calculation done from time to time to make sure you are still on track. So you're not, you know, you did it 2 years, 3 years ago, and I'm, you know, very confident that I'm still on track. You'd also need to check on that on a annual basis to make sure. Also checking in with your, you know, credit report and making sure you don't have any erroneous information on your credit report, because, you know, maybe overconfident that, you know, I was at a 750 last year, I'm good to go, but something could have crept on your credit report in a year that you had no idea happened, or you could have been a victim of identity theft and didn't know it because you never checked your credit report. So you want to make sure you're not overconfident, because, like I said, overconfidence will also get you in more financial problems than anything else, because you're kind of status quo and you think everything is going according to plan, you don't kind of double check things. That also could cause you problems. So you want to make sure that you're double checking on an annual basis. If you're not working with an advisor, you can do it on your own, but making sure you're checking in on yourself to so you're doing the best that you can with your finances.
That is really one that I know that I personally experienced during the time when I was getting divorced from my first husband. We had had a situation where I sold out to him my half of the house when we got divorced. I did that because I wasn't getting any alimony or anything, and so it was a way that I was going to see that I could have some operating money to get a new start with. And I thought at the time that it wasn't a bad idea. It was my own idea, but I thought it was a pretty good idea. But I kept, whenever I would apply for credit, I kept being turned down, and I kept thinking, why will no bank let me get a car loan? You know, I kept thinking, well, I know I don't make the kind of money that I used to make when I had a joint income, but, you know, it's not a bad amount of money that I'm making. You know, why are they being so hard on me? And finally, I happened to have someone mention my terrible credit, and I'm thinking, I have terrible credit. I didn't think I had terrible credit. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at my credit report, and somehow the house was on my credit, and there was no way that on my earnings that I could have possibly managed that mortgage. So, therefore, my credit report had just gone to hell. I didn't deserve the fact that it had. So, I was innocently thinking, well, you know, I'm working hard, and, you know, certainly the next time that I decide that, you know, I would really like to get a better car because my car is old and falling apart, and, you know, I really think I deserve a new one, and I can't imagine why they wouldn't think that I could afford that. And, you know, then I just kept thinking, well, what do they know that I don't know? And that's what finally led me to look at my credit report. So it's just those type of things that I think, I guess I would probably have to say that I was, I knew I wasn't in a good situation, but I still was probably guilty of overconfidence because I knew my situation. It's just that my situation, as I saw it, wasn't how the financial world saw it.
Yeah, it wasn't how everyone else saw it. Yeah, exactly. That's the thing about overconfidence. If you see it, somebody else may see it in a different situation. That's why I always recommend, you know, when people say, hey, I'm good, you know, I'm fine, you know, got it all squared away, I always offer second opinion meetings with people because you never know. You know, it's a different set of eyes looking at it. You've been doing the same thing, continuously for a while, but there may be somebody else to take a look at and say, okay, had you thought about this? Had you thought about that? And sometimes, you know, that helps because, you know, at least it gets you out of that overconfidence that, you know, yeah, I thought I was doing okay and I thought, I had covered all my bases, but now you started getting me to think about maybe I can be doing something even better than I'm currently doing.
Right. Absolutely true. Now, I can't remember if it was you who sent me an article, but someone recently sent me an article from CNBC that was called The Retirement Plan That Never Happened. And in it, they discussed things like that unless you socked away a lot of money, retirement for many people is just not going to be the retirement that we grew up believing that retirement was going to be. And it also talks about that to think that you can finance a 40-year retirement is mathematically impossible. I was intrigued with this article, and I thought that it might go along a little bit with what we've been discussing here to see what your thoughts were on those sentences that I pulled out of that article.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw the article or not.
I have seen, you know, similar ones, and I actually wrote some articles for MarketWatch.com as well, and one of the articles I wrote was "It's Not Your Grandfather's Retirement," and it's similar to, you know, that is that, you know, it's gonna, the environment is a lot more different than what it used to be. And planning for 25, 30-year retirement is going to be challenging for a lot of people. So, you know, even if you, you know, have a fairly nice-sized nest egg, you know, there's a lot of variables that go into retirement planning. So even if you hadn't started as early as you thought that you should have, you really need to, you know, evaluate and make sure that all the bases are covered because there's so many moving parts, more so than what it was in our generation prior with our parents, is that, you know, one day you would just up and said, I'm retiring, and you put in your paperwork, and you got your pension, and you got your Social Security, and you got all of the nice perks with that, and then you didn't have to worry about it anymore. Everything was kind of on autopilot, but it's so many moving parts when it comes to retirement planning now that you really need to, you know, kind of run those numbers on a consistent basis to make sure you're still saving enough for retirement. And then, you know, looking at some of those other things. I know in several conversations we talked about the increased cost of health care, Medicare, Social Security, how all of that fits into the overall retirement planning strategy. But it's going to be challenging.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm going to kind of round up the call here because we are just a little bit after the top of the hour. Mm-hmm. But I want to say that, as usual, it's been great talking with you, and thank you for being my guest and for the great discussion on these eight money-sabotaging emotions. Is there anything else that we haven't discussed that you've been thinking about in the background that you'd like to bring into this conversation before we close it?
No, I think I addressed all of the eight emotions, and that's you know, kind of rounds out the phone call for today. But the emphasis being, you know, if people were on the previous call, the habits and the emotions kind of tie in together. So if you're seeing yourself experience any of these, hopefully the suggestions and the reframes that I went through on the habits as well as the emotions will help. Because, you know, from time to time, we all get stuck. You know, we have to make financial decisions, but we get overwhelmed, we get stuck, we experience certain emotions. So if we're aware of those, at least that's kind of one thing that we have. You know, if you become aware of your emotions, at least you hit the first step on making some corrections and some steps to overcome those. So hopefully people got that out of both phone calls for this particular topic.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time and for discussing this topic, you know, over two session because it really is important things that we need to be looking at as we try to figure out how to manage to get to retirement, especially if we haven't been saving that huge amount of money that it now seems like that we should have been, and that maybe our children are starting to do. Maybe they're learning from us for a change.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. I want to make sure that everyone who's listening to us knows that if they have a question for you after the call, that they can email them to you at Pamela at JacksonSams.com. That's JacksonSams.com. Or you can go to Pam's website at www.jacksonsams.com. And there on that website, you'll find that she has a wealth of free information on a wide variety of financial topics. And if anybody who's listening wants to know more about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, you can find us online at our website, www.nabbw.com. We have a forum where I try to keep current, well, the forum is called BoomerWomenSpeak.com, and that's where just people get on and talk about whatever is concerning them at the time. And as far as the Facebook page, we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/NABBW, and I try to post things, especially interesting articles and our situations. I try to post some couple articles a day onto that site. So those are places where hopefully anyone who's listening who would like to know more about either you, Pam, or NABBW can get more information. And with that, and trying to keep to the time frame that we promised everyone on the call, I'm going to say thanks, everyone, for joining us for tonight, and good evening. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.